In many respects, however, nothing changed. John felt the same as before, except it didn't take Omegendorf to get an occasional buzz humming through him, as if he had recently finished swimming a couple of kilometers, or cross-country skied for an afternoon, or, yes, taken a dose of Omegendorf, which now would have been carrying coals to Newcastle, because things glowed. When he took the crest walk, the whole visible world glowed. Stilled bulldozers, a crane like a gallows, he could watch anything for minutes on end. Maya left for Hellas, and it didn't matter. Their relations were back on the old roller coaster ride, a lot of bickering and fits of temper on her part, but all that seemed unimportant, floating inside the glow, changing nothing in the way he felt toward her, or in the way she had, from time to time, turned on him that look of hers. He would see her in a few months and talk to her on screen. Meanwhile, this was a separation he wasn't entirely unhappy to see. It was a good winter. He learned a lot about aerobotany and bioengineering, and in many of the evenings after dinner he would ask the Acheron people, both individually and severally, what they thought the eventual Martian society should be like, and how it should be run. At Acheron, this usually led directly to considerations of ecology and its deformed offshoot, economics. These, to them, were much more critical than politics, or what Marina called the supposed decision-making apparatus. Marina and Vlad were particularly interesting on this topic, as they had worked out a system of equations for what they called eco-economics. He liked listening to them explain the equations, and he asked them a lot of questions, learning about concepts like carrying capacity, coexistence, counteradaptation, legitimacy mechanisms, and ecologic efficiency. "That's the only real measure of our contribution to the system," Vlad would say. "If you burn our bodies in a microbomb calorimeter, you'll find we contain about 6 or 7 kilocalories per gram of weight, and of course we take in a lot of calories to sustain that through our lives. Our output is harder to measure, because it's not a matter of predators feeding on us, as in the classic efficiency equations. It's more a matter of how many calories we create by our efforts, or send on to future generations, something like that. And most of that is very indirect, naturally, and it involves a lot of speculation and subjective judgment. If you don't go ahead and assign values to a number of non-physical things, then electricians and plumbers and reactor builders and other infrastructural workers would always rate as the most productive members of society, while artists and the like would be seen as contributing nothing at all." "Sounds about right to me," John joked, but Vlad and Marina ignored him. "Anyway, that's a large part of what economics is. People arbitrarily, or as a matter of taste, assigning numerical values to non-numerical things, and then pretending that they haven't just made the numbers up, which they have. Economics is like astrology in that sense, except that economics serves to justify the current power structure, and so it has a lot of fervent believers among the powerful." "Better just to concentrate on what we're doing here," Marina put in. "The basic equation is simple. Efficiency merely equals the calories you put out, divided by the calories you take in, times 100, to put it in the form of a percentage. In the classic sense of passing along calories to one's predator, 10% was average, and 20% doing really well. Most predators at the tops of food chains did more like 5%. "This is why tigers have ranges of hundreds of square kilometers," Vlad said. "Robber barons are not really very efficient." "So tigers don't have predators, not because they're so tough, but because it's not worth the effort," John said. "Exactly." "The problem is in calculating the values," Marina said. "We've had to simply assign certain calorie-equivalent numerical values to all kinds of activities, and then go on from there." "But we were talking about economics," John said. "But this is economics, don't you see? This is our eco-economics. Everyone should make their living, so to speak, based on a calculation of their real contribution to the human ecology. Everyone can increase their ecological efficiency by efforts to reduce how many kilocalories they use. This is the old Southern argument against the energy consumption of the Northern industrial nations. There was a real ecologic basis to that objection because no matter how much the industrial nations produced, in the larger equation, they couldn't be as efficient as the South. They were predators on the South, John said. Yes, and they will become predators on us, too, if we let them. And like all predators, their efficiency is low. But here, you see, in this theoretical state of independence that you speak of, she grinned at John's look of consternation, you do. You have to admit that that is ultimately what you talk about all the time, John. Well, there it should be the law that people are rewarded in proportion to their contribution to the system. Dmitri, coming in the lab, said, from each according to his capacities, to each according to his needs. No, that's not the same, Vlad said. What it means is, you get what you pay for. But that's already true, John said. How is this different from the economics that already exists? They all scoffed at once, Marina most persistently. There's all kinds of phantom work. Unreal values assigned to most of the jobs on Earth. The entire transnational executive class does nothing a computer couldn't do, and there are whole categories of parasitical jobs that add nothing to the system by an ecologic accounting. Advertising, stock brokerage, the whole apparatus for making money only from the manipulation of money. That is not only wasteful, but corrupting, as all meaningful money values get distorted in such manipulation. She waved a hand in disgust. Well, Vlad said, we can say that their efficiency is very low and that they predate on the system without having any predators, so that they are either the top of the chain or parasitical, depending on how you define it. Advertising, money brokering, some types of manipulation of the law, some politics. But all of these are subjective judgments, John exclaimed. How have you actually assigned caloric values to such a variety of activities? Well, we've done our best to calculate what they contribute back to the system in terms of well-being measured as a physical thing. What does the activity equal in terms of food, or water, or shelter, or clothing, or medical aid, or education, or free time? We've talked it over, and usually everyone at Acheron has offered a number, and we've taken the mean. Here, let me show you. And they would talk through the evening about it before the computer screen, and John would ask questions and plug Pauline in to record the screens and tape the discussions, and they would go through the equations and jab their fingers at the flowcharts, and then stop for coffee and perhaps take it up to the crest, to pace the length of the greenhouse arguing vehemently about the human value in kilocalories of plumbing, opera, simulation programming, and the like. They were up on the crest, in fact, one afternoon near sunset, when John looked up from the equation on his wrist pad and stared up the long slope toward Olympus Mons. The sky had darkened. It occurred to him that it might be just another double eclipse. Phobos was so close overhead that it blocked a third of the sun when it crossed in front of it, and Deimos about a ninth. And a couple of times a month they crossed at the same time, causing a shadow to be cast across the land, as if a film had got in your eye or you had had a bad thought. But this wasn't an eclipse. Olympus Mons was hidden from view, and the high southern horizon was a fuzzy bronze bar. Look at that, he said to the others and pointed. A dust storm. They hadn't had a global dust storm in over 10 years. John called up the weather satellite photos on his wrist pad. The origin of the storm had been near the Thaumasia Mohole, Senzeni Na. He called up Sachs and found him blinking philosophically, stating his surprise in mild tones. Winds at the edge of the storm were up to 660 kilometers an hour, Sachs said. A new planetary record. It looks like this is going to be a big one. I thought the cryptogamic soils in the storm startup zones would have dampened them, or even stopped them. Obviously, that model had something wrong with it. Okay, Sachs, too bad about that, but it'll be okay. I gotta go now because it's rolling right down on us now, and I want to watch. Have fun, Sax said deadpan before John clicked him off. Vlad and Ursula were scoffing at Sax's model, temperature gradients between biotically defrosted soil and the remaining frosted areas would be greater than ever, and the winds between the two regions correspondingly fiercer, so that when they finally hit loose fines, off they would go. Totally obvious. Now that it's happened, John said. He laughed and moved down the greenhouse to watch the storm's approach by himself. Scientists could be so catty. The wall of dust rolled down the long lava slopes of Olympus Mons's northern aureole. It had already halved the land visible since John first saw it, and now it approached like a giant breaking wave, a billowy chocolate milk wave 10,000 meters high, with a bronze filigree foaming up and off it, leaving great curved streamers in the pink sky above. "Wow!" John cried. "Here it comes! Here it comes!" Suddenly the crest of the Acheron fin seemed located a great distance above the long, narrow canyons of the fossae below them, and lower fin ridges reared like dragon backs out of the cracked lava, a wild place from which to face the onrush of such a storm, too high, too exposed. John laughed again and pressed himself against the southern windows of the greenhouse, looking down, out, around, shouting, "Wow! Wow! Look at it go! Wow!" And then suddenly they were overwhelmed, dust flying over them, darkness, a high, whooshing shriek. The first impact against Acheron Ridge caused a wild flurry of turbulence, quick cyclonic twisters that appeared and disappeared, horizontal, vertical, at angles up the few steep gullies in the ridge. The general shriek was punctuated by booms as these disturbances hit the ridge and collapsed. Then, with dreamlike rapidity, the wind settled into a smooth standing wave, and the dust rushed up past John's face. The pit of his stomach lifted, as if the greenhouse were suddenly dropping with violent speed. Certainly, that's what it looked like, as the ridge had caused a ferocious updraft. Stepping back, however, he saw the dust streaming overhead and then off to the north. On that side of the greenhouse, he could see for a few kilometers before the wind smashed into the ground again and cut off the view in continual explosions of dust. Wow! His eyes were dry, and his mouth felt a bit caked. Lots of the fines were less than a micron across. Was that a faint sheen of them, there already across the bamboo leaves? No, only the weird light of the storm. But there would be dust on everything eventually. No seal system could keep it out. Vlad and Ursula were not completely confident of the greenhouse's ability to withstand the wind, and they encouraged everyone up there to go downstairs. On the way down, John re-established contact with Sax. Sax's mouth was bunched into a tighter knot than usual. They would lose a lot of insulation with this storm, he said evenly. Equatorial surface temperatures had been averaging 18 degrees higher than the baseline figures, but temperatures near Thalmasia were already down 6 degrees, and they would continue to plummet for the duration of the storm. And, he added, with what seemed to John an almost masochistic completeness, the Mohol thermals would loft the dust higher than ever before, so that it was all too possible that the storm might last for a long time. "Buck up, Sax," John advised. "I think it'll be shorter than ever before. Don't be so pessimistic." Later on, when the storm was going into its second M year, Sax would remind John of this prediction with a little laugh. Traveling during the storm was officially restricted to the trains and to certain heavily used double transponder roads, but when it became obvious that it wasn't going to die back down that summer, John ignored the restrictions and resumed his wanderings. He made sure that his rover was well stocked, he had a backup rover follow him, and he had an extra powerful radio transmitter installed. That and Pauline in the driver's seat would be enough to get him around most of the Northern Hemisphere, he figured. Rover breakdowns were rare because of the really comprehensive internal monitoring systems hooked into their control computers. Two rover breakdowns at once was unheard of. There had been only a single recorded fatality as a result of that happening. So he said goodbye to the Acheron group and took off again. Driving in the storm was like driving at night, except more interesting. The dust rocketed by in gusts, leaving little pockets of visibility that gave him quick, dim, sepia snatches of a view, the landscape rolling, everything seeming to be moving south. Then blank, rushing tempests of dust would return again, flush against the windows. The rover rocked hard on its shock absorbers during the worst gusts, and the dust did indeed get into everything. On the fourth day of his drive, he turned straight south and began to drive up the northwest slope of the Tharsis Bulge. This was the great escarpment again, but here it was not a cliff, only a slope imperceptible in the storm's dark, lasting for more than a day until he was high on the side of Tharsis, 5 vertical kilometers higher than he had been in Acheron. He stopped at another mine, located near crater PT, called Pete, located in the upper end of the Tantalus Fossae. Apparently the Tharsis Bulge had initiated the great lava flood covering Alba Patera, and later bulging had then cracked the lava shield. These were the Tantalus Canyons. Some of them had cracked over a platinoid-rich mafic igneous intrusion that the miners had named the Marensky Reeflets. The miners were real Azanians this time, but Azanians who called themselves Afrikaners and spoke Afrikaner among themselves. White men who welcomed John with heavy doses of God, Volk, and Trek. They had named the canyons they worked in New Orange Free State and New Pretoria. And they, like the miners at Bradbury Point, worked for Arms Corps. "Yes," the operations head said happily. He had a heavily jowled face, a ski-jump nose, and a big crooked smile, and a very intense manner. "We've found iron, copper, silver, manganese, aluminum, gold, platinum, titanium, chromium, you name it. Sulfides, oxides, silicates, native metals, you name it. The Great Escarpment has them all." The mine had been running for about an M-year. It consisted of strip mines on the canyon floors with a habitat half buried in the mesa between 2 of the largest canyons, looking like a clear eggshell packed with a meat of green trees and orange tile roofs. John spent several days with them, being sociable and asking questions. More than once, thinking of the Acheron group's eco-economics, he asked them how they were going to get their valuable but heavy product back to Earth. Would the energy cost of the transfer overwhelm the potential profit? "Of course," they said, just like the men at Bradbury Point. "It will take the space elevator to make it worthwhile," their chief said. "With the space elevator, we're in the Terran market. Without it, we will never get off Mars." "That's not necessarily a bad thing," John said. But they didn't understand him, and when he tried to explain it, they only went blank and nodded politely, anxious to avoid thinking about politics, which was something Afrikaners were good at. When John realized what was going on, he found he could bring up the topic of politics to get some time to himself. It was, he said to Maya one night on the wrist, like tossing a tear gas canister in the room. It even enabled him to wander into the mining operations center alone for most of an afternoon, linking Pauline to the records and recording everything that she could lift. Pauline noticed no unusual patterns in the operation, but she did flag an exchange of communications with the Arms Corps home office. The local group wanted a security unit of 100 persons, and Singapore had agreed to do it. John whistled. "What about Unoma?" Security was supposed to be entirely their purview, and they gave out approval for private security pretty routinely. But 100 people? John instructed Pauline to look into the Unoma dispatches on the subject and left for dinner with the Afrikaners. Again, the space elevator was declared a necessity. "They'll just pass us by if we don't have it. Go straight out to the asteroids and not have any gravity well to worry about, eh?" Despite the 500 micrograms of Omegendorf in his system, John was not in a happy mood. "Tell me," he said at one point, "do any women work here?" They stared at him like fish. They were even worse than Moslems, really. He left the next day and drove up to Pavonis, intent on looking into the space elevator notion. up the long slope of Tharsis. He never saw the steep blood-colored cone of Ascrius Mons. It was lost in the dust along with everything else. Travel now consisted of life in a set of small rooms that bumped around a lot. He worked his way around Ascrius on its west flank, and then motored up onto the crest of Tharsis, between Ascrius and Pavonis. Here the double transponder road became an actual concrete ribbon under the wheels, concrete under a rush of dust, concrete that finally tilted up sharply and led him straight up the northern slope of Pavonis Mons. It went on for so long that it began to feel like a slow, blind takeoff into space. The crater of Pavonis, as the Afrikaners had reminded him, was amazingly equatorial. The round O of its caldera sat like a ball placed right on the equator line. This apparently made the south rim of Pavonis the perfect tethering point for a space elevator, as it was both directly on the equator and 27 kilometers above the datum. Phyllis had already arranged for the construction of a preliminary habitat on the south rim. She had thrown herself into work on the elevator and was one of its chief organizers. Her habitat was dug into the rim wall of the caldera in Ekis Overlook style, so that windows in several stories of rooms looked out over the caldera, or wood, when the dust cleared. Photos blown up and stuck on the walls showed that the caldera itself would eventually be revealed as a simple circular depression with walls 5,000 meters deep, slightly terraced near the bottom. The caldera had slumped often in earlier days, but always in nearly the same place. It was the only one of the great volcanoes to have been so regular. The other three had calderas that were like sets of overlapping circles, with each circle set at a different depth. The new habitat, nameless at this point, had been built by Unoma, but the equipment and personnel had been provided by the transnational Praxis, one of the biggest of them all. Currently, the rooms that were finished were crowded with Praxis executives, or executives of some of the other transnationals who had subcontracts on the elevator project. Among them were representatives of Amex, Orico, Tsubarashi, and Mitsubishi. And all their efforts were being coordinated by Phyllis, who was now apparently Helmut Bronsky's assistant in charge of the operation. Helmut, too, was there, and after John had greeted him and Phyllis and had been introduced to some of the visiting consultants, John was led into a big high room with a window wall. Outside the window swirled clouds of dark orange dust dropping down into the caldera, so that it seemed that the room ascended uncertainly in a dim, fluctuating light. The room's only furnishing was a globe of Mars 1 meter in diameter, resting waist-high on a blue plastic stand. Extending from the globe, specifically from the little bump that represented Pavonis Mons, was a silver wire about 5 meters long. At the end of the thread was a small black dot. The globe was rotating on the stand at about 1 RPM, and the silver wire and its terminating black dot rotated with it, always remaining above Pavonis. A group of about 8 people ringed this display. "Everything is set to scale," Phyllis said. "The aerosynchronous satellite distance is 20,435 kilometers from the center of mass, and the equatorial radius is 3,386 kilometers, so the distance from the surface to the aerosynchronous point is 17,049 kilometers. Double that and add the radius, and you have 37,484 kilometers. We'll have a ballast rock at the far end, so the actual cable won't have to be as long as it would be without it. The diameter of the cable will be about 10 meters and will weigh about 6 billion tons. The material for it will have been mined from its terminal ballast point, which will be an asteroid that starts at around 13.5 billion tons and ends up, when the cable is finished, at the proper ballast weight of around 7.5 billion tons. That's not a very big asteroid, about 2 kilometers in radius to begin with. There are 6 Amor asteroids crossing Mars's orbit that have been identified as candidates for the job. The cable will be manufactured by robots mining and processing the carbon in the asteroid's chondrites. Then, in the last stages of construction, the cable will be maneuvered to its tethering point here. She pointed at the floor of the room in dramatic fashion. At that point, the cable will be in aryosynchronous orbit itself, barely touching down here, its weight suspended between the pull of the planet's gravity and the centrifugal force of the upper part of the cable and the terminal ballast rock. What about Phobos? John asked. Phobos is way down there, of course. The cable will be vibrating to avoid it in what the designers call a Clark oscillation. It won't be a problem. Deimos will also have to be avoided by oscillation, but because its orbit is more inclined, this won't be such a frequent problem. And when it's in position? Helmut asked, his face bright with pleasure. A few hundred elevators at least will be attached to the cable, and loads will be lifted into orbit using a counterweight system. There will be lots of material to load down from Earth as usual, so energy requirements for lifts will be minimized. It will also be possible to use the cable's rotation as a slingshot. Objects released from a ballast asteroid toward Earth will be using the power of Mars's rotation as their push, and will have an energy-free high-speed takeoff. It's a clean, efficient, extraordinarily cheap method, both for lifting bulk into space and for accelerating it toward Earth. And given the recent discoveries of strategic metals, which are becoming ever more scarce on Earth, a cheap lift and push like this is literally invaluable. It creates the possibility of an exchange that wasn't economically viable before. It will be a critical component of the Martian economy, the keystone of its industry, and it won't be that expensive to build. Once a carbonaceous asteroid is pushed into the proper orbit and a nuclear-powered robotic cable plant put to work on it, the plant will extrude cable like a spider spinning its thread. There will be very little to do but wait. The cable plant, as designed, we'll be able to produce over 3,000 kilometers of cable a year. This means we need to start as soon as possible, but after production begins, it will only take 10 or 11 years, and the wait will be well worth it. John stared at Phyllis, impressed as always by her fervor. She was like a convert giving witness, a preacher in a pulpit, quietly and confidently triumphant. The miracle of the skyhook. Jack and the Beanstalk, the ascension to heaven, it definitely had an air of the miraculous to it. Really, we don't have much choice, Phyllis was saying. This gets us out of our gravity well, eliminating it as a physical and economic problem. That's crucial. Without that, we'll be bypassed. We'll be like Australia in the 19th century, too far away to be a significant part of the world economy. People will pass us by and mine the asteroids directly, because the asteroids have mineral wealth without gravitational constraints. Without the elevator, we would become a backwater. Shikata Ganai, John thought sardonically. Phyllis glanced very briefly at John as if he had spoken aloud. We won't let that happen, she said. And best of all, our elevator will serve as an experimental prototype for a Terran one. The transnationals who gain expertise in building this elevator will be in a commanding position when it comes to bidding the contracts for the much larger Terran project that is sure to follow. On and on she went, outlining every aspect of the plan and then answering questions from the executives with her usual polished brilliance. She got a lot of laughs. She was flushed, bright-eyed. John could almost see the tongues of fire flickering from her mass of auburn hair, which in the stormlight looked like a cap of jewels. The executives and project scientists glowed under her look. They were on to something big, and they knew it. Earth was seriously depleted in many of the metals they were finding on Mars. There were fortunes to be made, enormous fortunes. And someone who owned a piece of the bridge over which every ounce of metal had to pass would make an enormous fortune as well, probably the greatest fortune of all. No wonder Phyllis and the rest of them looked like they were in church. Before dinner that evening, John stood in his bathroom and, without looking at himself in the mirror, took out 2 tabs of Omegendorf and swallowed them. He was sick of Phyllis, but the drug made him feel better. Phyllis was just another part of the game, after all, and when he sat down to dinner, he was in an expansive mood. Okay, he thought, they have their gold mine of a beanstalk, but it wasn't clear that they would be able to keep it to themselves, highly unlikely, in fact, so that their fat cat complacency was a bit silly, as well as grating. And he laughed in the middle of one of their enthusiastic exchanges and said, "Don't you think it unlikely that an elevator like this will stay private property?" "We don't intend for it to be private property," Phyllis said with her brilliant smile. "But you expect to be paid for its construction, and then you expect concessions to be granted. You expect to make a profit from the venture. Isn't that what venture capitalism is all about?" "Well, of course," Phyllis said, looking offended that he had spoken of such things so explicitly. "Everyone on Mars will profit from it. That's its nature."
"And you'll skim a percentage of every percentage."
"Predators at the top of the chain, or else parasites up and down the length of it. How rich did the builders of the Golden Gate Bridge get, do you think? Were there great transnational dynasties formed from the profits of the Golden Gate Bridge? No. It was a public project, wasn't it? The builders were public employees making a standard wage for their work. What do you want to bet that the Mars Treaty doesn't stipulate a similar arrangement for infrastructural construction here? I'm pretty sure it does."
"But the treaty is up for revision in 9 years," Phyllis pointed out, her eyes glittering.
John laughed.
"So it is. But you wouldn't believe the support I see around this planet for a revised treaty that sets even tighter limits on Terran investment and profit. You just haven't been paying attention. The thing you have to remember is that this is an economic system being built from scratch on principles that make sense in scientific terms. There's only a limited carrying capacity here, and to create a sustainable society, we've got to pay attention to that. You can't just lift raw materials from here to Earth. The colonial era is over. You have to remember that."
He laughed again at the glinty stares being leveled on him. It was like gun sights had been implanted in their corneas. And it only occurred to him later, back in his room and remembering those looks, that it probably hadn't been a very good idea to stick their noses in the situation so hard. The Amex man had even lifted his wrist to his mouth to take down a note, in a gesture obviously meant to be seen. "This John Boone was bad news," he had whispered, eyes on John all the while. He had wanted John to see him. Well, another suspect, then. But it took John a while to get to sleep that night. He left Pavonis the next day and headed east down Tharsis, intending to drive a full 7,000 kilometers to Hellas to visit Maya. The journey was made strangely solitary by the great storm. He glimpsed the southern highlands in murky snatches only, through billowing sheets of sand with the ever-shifting whistle of the wind as accompaniment. Maya was pleased he was coming to visit. He had never been to Hellas before, and a lot of people there were looking forward to meeting him. They had discovered a sizable aquifer to the north of Low Point. So their plan was to pump water from that aquifer to the surface and create a lake in the Low Point. A lake with a frozen surface which would be continuously subliming into the atmosphere, but which they would keep supplied from below. Sustained in that way, it would both enrich the atmosphere and serve as a reservoir and heat sink for cultivation in a ring of domed farms built around the lake shore. Maya was very excited at the plans. John's long journey toward her passed in a mesmerized state as he watched crater after crater loom out of the clouds of dust. One evening he stopped at a Chinese settlement where they knew hardly a word of English and lived in boxes like the trailer park. He and the settlers had to make use of an AI translation program, which kept them both laughing for most of the evening. 2 days later, he stopped for a day at a huge Japanese air mining facility in a high pass between craters. Here, everyone spoke excellent English, but they were frustrated because the air miners had been brought to a standstill by the storm. The technicians smiled painfully and escorted him through a nightmare complex of filtering systems that they had set up to try to keep the pumps working. And all for naught.
east 3 days from the Japanese, he ran across a Sufi caravanserai located on top of a circular steep-walled mesa. This particular mesa had once been a crater floor, but it had been so hardened by impact metamorphosis that it had resisted the erosion that had cut away the surrounding soft land in the eons that followed, and now it stood above the plain like a thick, round pedestal, its furrowed sides a kilometer high. John drove up a switchbacking ramp road to the caravanserai on top. Up there, he found that the mesa was situated in a permanent standing wave in the dust storm, so that there was more sunlight leaking through the dark clouds here than anywhere else he had been, even on the rim of Pavonis. Visibility was almost as truncated as everywhere else, but everything was more brightly colored. The dawns purple and chocolate, the days a vivid cloudy rush of umbers and yellow, orange and rust, pierced by the occasional bronzed sunbeam. It was a great spot, and the Sufis proved to be more hospitable than any of the Arab groups he had met so far. They had come up in one of the latest Arab groups, they told him, as a concession to religious factions in the Arab world back home. And as Sufis were numerous among Islamic scientists, there had been very few objections to sending them as a coherent group of their own. One of them, a small black man named Duel Noon, said to him, "It's wonderful in this time of the 70,000 veils that you, the great Talib, have followed this tariqat here to visit us." "Talib?" John said. "Tariqat?" "A Talib is a seeker, and the seeker's tariqat is his path, his special path, you know, on the road to reality." "I see," John said, still surprised at the friendliness of their greeting. Du led him from the garage to a low black building which stood in the center of a ring of rovers, looking dense with concentrated energy. A squat, round thing like a model of the mesa itself, its windows rough, clear crystals. Du identified the black rock of the building as stishovite, a high-density silicate created by the meteor's impact when pressures of over 1,000,000 kilograms per square centimeter had momentarily existed. The windows were made of le chatelierite, a kind of compressed glass also created by the impact. Inside the building, a party of about 20 people greeted him, both men and women alike. The women were bareheaded and behaved just like the men, which again surprised John and alerted him to the fact that things among the Sufis were different than they were among Arabs generally. He sat down and drank coffee with them and started asking questions again. They were Qatarite Sufis, they told him, pantheists influenced by early Greek philosophy and modern existentialism, trying by modern science and the Ru'yat al-Kab, the vision of the heart, to become one with that ultimate reality which was God. "There are 4 mystical journeys," Du said to him. "The first begins with gnosis and ends with fana, or passing away from all phenomenal things. The second begins when fana is succeeded by baka, or abiding. At this point, you journey in the real, by the real, to the real, and you yourself are a reality, a hawk. And after that, you move on to the center of the spirit universe and become one with all others who have done likewise." "I guess I haven't begun the first journey yet," John said. "I don't know anything." They were pleased by this response, he could see. "You can start," they told him, and poured him more coffee. "You can always start." They were so encouraging and friendly compared to any of the Arabs John had met before that he opened up to them and told him about his trip to Pavonis and the plans for the great elevator cable. "No fancy in the world is all untrue," Du said. And when John mentioned his last meeting with Arabs on Vastidus Borealis and how Frank had been accompanying them, Du said cryptically, "It's the love of right lures men to wrong." One of the women laughed and said, "Chalmers is your nafs." "What's that?" John asked. They were all laughing. Du, shaking his head, said, "He is not your nafs. One's nafs is one's evil self,
which some used to believe lived in one's chest, like an organ or something? Like an actual creature. Muhammad ibn Ulyan, for instance, reported that something like a young fox leaped out of his throat, and when he kicked it, it only got bigger. That was his nafs. It is another name for your shadow, the woman who had brought it up explained. Well, John said, maybe he is then. Or maybe it's just that Frank's nafs gets kicked a lot. And they laughed with him at the thought.